As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, you're listening to the Game Podcast from The Times. My name is Hugh Wisencroft. It's Monday morning, which means we've got a lot to talk about. We're going to be looking at the sheer number of goals already scored in the Premier League. Another great weekend for that. Also, Son and Kane spark a fuse at Spurs this season, but Dele Alli seems to have lost his shine. We'll ask why. Who deserves the flak at Manchester United after their defeat? And the final word in today's The Game supplement in The Times focuses on the new and dreaded, let's face it, handball rule. We'll dissect that as well. And by the way, The Times today also features a great interview with Gary Lineker talking about Mason Greenwood and Phil Foden. He says they were stupid, but it's time to move on. He's been speaking to our dear colleague Henry Winter. Check that one out if you can. But without further ado, our cast of journalistic superstars today, Tom Clark, Matt Dickinson and Gregor Robertson. Hello, guys.
Hi, Hugh. How are we?
I'm all right, mate. I don't know if you can hear, it was my birthday this weekend.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. It means that I may be feeling a little bit rough in terms of my voice today. The missus has just brought me a nice lemon and honey tea. It means I might leave all the talking to you guys, to be perfectly honest.
Well, I'm sure Leeds fans send their best wishes to you and say happy birthday and hope that you had a lovely time.
I thank them. I celebrated their victory this weekend more than Manchester United being beaten, of course. Matt, it's our debut together. So I wanted to suck up to you by asking you about your article today, obviously, on Kepa, Aretha Balaga, having watched that Chelsea game yesterday.
Yes, I think a game when Kepa screws up seems to come around most weeks, doesn't it? It's you've got to feel sorry for him in the sense of watching a goalie suffer like that. It almost feels a bit agonising. But at the same time, Chelsea has spent a lot of money to be upwardly mobile in the top flight, and he's going to stop him at this rate. I mean, as I wrote, sort of accident waiting to happen, you don't have to wait very long for it. And in Mane's case, he didn't wait at all. Just charge him down, put some pressure on, wait for the guy to crack. And there was something sort of quite sadly predictable about it.
Yeah, another horror moment in the 2-0 defeat by Liverpool. Liverpool looking pretty good this weekend. Manchester United, though, the opposite, beaten at home by Crystal Palace, 3-1, poor. Let's be honest, but continued their poor form, really, that we saw as they exited the Europa League. The question is who to blame. You see the reaction on social media from fans. You hear journalists dissecting it. Is it Ed Woodward, the executive vice chairman? Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the manager? Should he have sorted it out by now? Are the players good enough? Which is a big one, which I think, let's be honest, most of those players at Manchester United should have been capable of going past Crystal Palace in terms of individual talent. Plenty of fingers being pointed, but who's to blame?
I mean, I mean, you all know who I'm going to say, so I'm going to back out of kicking Ole Gunnar Solskjaer too soon. I mean, I would just pick up on one point you said there, Hugh. You talked about the players being as good as Crystal Palace. I don't know whether some of them are as good as Crystal Palace. I think there's this strange thing we still hangover we've got about Manchester United, about how good they actually are. They're not that good, are they? Like, the players aren't that good. I mean, Luke Shaw's not a left back of any kind of great quality beyond a mid-table Premier League side. Scott McTominay is going to be one of those players that will play for a few seasons at Manchester United and then he'll get a move to West Brom or West Ham or something and then he'll be at his level. Like, it's not that surprising, this Manchester United team losing to a well-drilled Crystal Palace side with a player of Wilfred Zaha's ability who, when he turns it on, is one of the most talented attackers in the Premier League. I just don't think it's that surprising. They're an okay side. They punched above their weight last season. They've got some good young attackers. I don't think it's that much of a surprise when they lose to Crystal Palace.
They did finish third in the Premier League last season, which might make it a little bit of a surprise. But
yeah, they did very well. They did very well. Anyway,
I'll try and put a little bit of a case for the defence in that 35 days, I think, since they exited the Europa League. I believe they had 10 days holiday. players quarantining, Wan-Bissaka quarantining, Dan James looks completely devoid of any sort of confidence. Maguire and Greenwood, as you both know, had pretty traumatic summers in that 10-day break. So there are some, you know, there are some mitigating factors. But, you know, look, the debate about Manchester United has not changed. It's, you know, you can, everyone rushes out and says they need to sign new players. And there's an element of truth to that. But they've signed a lot of players that aren't good enough in the past. So there's nothing to say they're going to improve upon that. And there's still question marks about Solskjaer, because if you look at the team, I disagree with Tom. I mean, that team is full of attacking talent, particularly. They're not going to do anything with Luke Shaw and Lindelof in the back line. So that needs to be improved upon. But Manchester United are better than what we saw there. And part of that's to do with, I still believe, the man in the dugout, and part of it's to do with this crazy season we're just embarking upon.
So we've got two managers already, let's be honest. Greg has just mentioned Solskjaer. Tom says it's Solskjaer. Matt Dickinson, is it the manager after one game?
Well, the owners, I dug my trench pretty deep when Solskjaer was appointed and said, you know, it just struck me crackers when, you know, someone like Pochettino was clearly, or by that stage, already unsettled at Spurs. And you know, I just thought there was a chance that, you know, you should throw everything at going for someone like Pochettino rather than go for someone like Solskjaer, who was, you know, a large part of his appeal was simply that, you know, he was, you know, had the DNA. And, you know, the irony is, of course, that towards the end of last season, there was, you know, a lot of signs of improvement. I mean, Bruno Fernandes was turned out to be one of the best, probably, I think, the best signing of last season. I thought there were signs of United making some progress. So I'm not, you know, I wouldn't say I was won over. Oh, yes, I was wrong on Solskjaer. But, you know, I thought, OK, this guy's doing OK. He's starting to make a team pretty watchable. Pretty progressive, and so I'm not about to sort of, you know, lurch back and say, you know, oh, this proves he's hopeless after a dodgy performance. But I think that the signs are very clear at the back end of the team. They've got big problems. You know, as the guys have said, I disagree with Tom. At the front end of that team, the fronts, yeah, you can put together a front, you know, five that should be easily capable of being a champion, you know, Champions League level team. It's the back end which is weak. You know, De Gea, we know, has had the wobbles. Lindelof, full of inconsistency. The fullback positions, you know, Wan-Bissaka not playing, suddenly they're exposed. So I think there's issue. And all for all the talk of spending all that money on Sancho, I think the money needs to go somewhere else in the team.
I think I'd agree with that, Matt. As a Manchester United fan, a lot of people talk about the transfers at Manchester United. The team, the best 11 players all fit at Manchester United, should well be capable of beating teams like Crystal Palace and probably qualifying for the Champions League. But as soon as Manchester United make a few changes, Dan James starting a game, for example, they lose something. I know Greenwood was on the bench. McTominay in midfield, they lose something. And it's a big drop-off. I think we saw in the FA Cup game against Norwich when he changed a lot of players, and against LASK in the Europa League. When they make six or seven changes, Manchester United, I mean, it might as well be a mid-table team. I think Tom's probably got the point right on that. The best players at Manchester United playing at their best, you know, there is high quality, but there's inconsistency. There's a lot of inconsistency at Manchester United. And I'm not worried about the season, but then my expectations are low, and they have been low year on year. So if Manchester United finished fourth, I'd be absolutely delighted. If Manchester United reached the Champions League next year, I'd be absolutely delighted. That for me is not what a club as big as Manchester United, with the resources that Manchester United have, should be aiming for. But again, if they want progression, they need to become, firstly, a team that's regularly in the Champions League, and then they can worry about progressing to another level. And on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I never have believed, and I still don't believe, that he will be the man for that. In fact, if you look at his record, reaching, 2 years at Manchester United, brilliant period at the start, they were on fire. Then another 15 games where they were patchy at best. 20 games where they're absolutely brilliant, winning virtually every week. And I think we've entered the second patchy stage now. They will never be a consistently brilliant team unless they have a brilliant manager.
It's coaching. They need better coaching, don't they? I mean, we talk about the best teams across the league, and we've done it so many times. The best teams have good coaches, the right system. And, you know, you've just said there, Hugh, about changing players around. The best teams can change players around and still get a result, can still play the way they want to play. You know, look at Arsenal. You're telling me that I've just slagged off Man United's team and squad. There's a lot of players in that Arsenal squad that once Mikel Arteta's got the squad he wants, they won't be anywhere near the team. But because he's a good coach, he can get a result for them, get them to play the way he wants. And that's where United fall down. As Matt says, yeah, they've got incredibly talented attackers. And when they all play and everyone clicks and everyone fires, yeah, they can score five or six. But then you need to be able to, when Palace turn up and Wilfred Zaha's on form, you need to find a way of breaking them down and getting a victory. And the coaching's not good enough to do that. Solskjaer's done a brilliant job. I'm giving him a kick in all the time, but he's done an excellent job. He's done far better than I thought he would. And third last season was unbelievable. But he's gone as far as they can go. And, you know, as you said, the signings is an interesting point as well, because Matt's mentioning Sancho. They're in a weird place in terms of the transfer market, which is a very different beast this summer. Where, you know, Edward Woods realised that he's maybe been mugged off a little bit in the transfer window at various different points, and he's got to try and be a bit clever about it when he's not really got that reputation. He's not got the reputation of a Michael Edwards, of a shrewd business operator. So he's got to try and work out a way of how can I get better deals. And in the meantime, the team still need to perform. So that's where you need a better coach, I think.
I just think there's nuance in this. It's, you know, they didn't lose because of Solskjaer at the weekend. They didn't lose, so that doesn't mean they just have to go out and spend £100 million on Sancho. Ed Woodward is to blame a little bit because he spent a lot of money pretty badly. But Manchester United should still be doing better than what we saw there. That's like uncontested. I also think we have to give some credit to Palace quickly. I mean, Zaha was outstanding. There's an absolutely great nugget in Bill Edgar's column today that says that in the last 2 years, Palace have scored 3 goals in a league match away against Liverpool, Man City, Man United and Arsenal. So there's very few teams in the Premier League, actually, who are as adept at setting up, being very difficult to break down, and then outstanding on the counter-attack. So, you know, I think Hodgson and Palace deserve credit too.
They do, but if you look at what Roy Hodgson's team did, I mean, that you would expect the minimum of a club like Manchester United, which was to everyone know their roles, for one, to be solid and execute it. It didn't happen. I mean, it didn't get remotely near happening for Manchester United. You say Solskjaer didn't lose the game, but it's a repetitive story. In fact, I was about to ask our producer John to just lift this piece of audio and we'll insert it every time Manchester United lose a game for the rest of the podcast, because it's going to be the same
That's
conversation.
True.
And yeah. At some point, the manager has to have some sort of responsibility over how his team plays. He knew what Crystal Palace... We all know what Crystal Palace were going to do. You know, are you telling me that a Jurgen Klopp, a Pep Guardiola, even a Frank Lampard sends a team out there that's devoid of creative ideas against Sacco, McCarthy, MacArthur, all who played well, by the way? But surely there is some sort of formula to get the best out of a side like Crystal Palace. Look at the videos, watch the tape, what has worked against them? Manchester United had no clue, really.
Yeah, well, I think Gregor did make the point. I think they have had... I sound like an excuse for them. I don't particularly want to. They underperformed, and there's no doubt about it. But I just think, you know, lurching in after the disruption, and they've had, you know, as much as many teams, if not more, in some ways. I think, you know, let's. I know it's not the world's greatest pundit line, but I do think we have to give it a couple of weeks before. Lurch into sort of huge conclusions from one game.
Oh, I think that's perfectly fine, Matt, to be perfectly honest with you.
It's sorry to be boringly sensible on
that's
that one,
fine.
But, you know...
I can agree with that. See, we should lurch in, but at the same time, completely agree with you in that we will be having this conversation about 20 times this season, if as long as Solskjaer is in the job. So that fact in itself is a pretty dispiriting one for Manchester United fans. They know, you know, it's kind of we're trudging along. It's okay. It's, you know, there's going to be little bursts of excellence and, you know, promise with Greenwood and players coming through, and, you know, they might make a big sign and it'll be like, oh, that's, you know, another few weeks they'll get a few results, and then this will happen again. We'll have the same debate and we'll have the same worries about Woodward and about Solskjaer, you know, up against the best coaches in the world, you know, who is competition in the Premier League. So that fact is quite dispiriting for Manchester United fans, and I can understand why on the first game of the season, you're like, oh, again.
And also the Rashford, I mean, I have to say, there are the bigger, you know, Rashford, I mean, what's happened to Rashford's form? It's gone, you know, it's been a long time since we thought, yeah, you know, Rashford looks like a player of vast promise. You know, where's his best position? Is he going to be a central striker? Could he play wide? You know, he can do both brilliantly. What, you know, what are we going to see from him? You know, we're sort of waiting for him to become, you know, one of the most sort of thrilling strikers around. And yeah, it's been a long time since we've had that discussion as well, which again, you know, is that about his mood? Is that and confidence? Is that about the talk of Sancho? Is that about the fact that Greenwood has almost usurped him? Is that about coaching? Is that about Solskjaer and what he's getting out of that talent?
There's another difficulty as well, isn't there? In the easy thing to say is, oh, they need to sign players. But we've seen already that the transfer window is a very different beast this time around. Clubs, even as big as Manchester United, will be feeling a slight financial pinch of the last few months. And as I said earlier, Ed Woodward doesn't want to, you know, be seen to be, you know, getting a bad deal for his club. I would argue that actually the signing of Donny van de Beek is probably one of the smartest transfers Manchester United have made in a long time, in terms of spotting a player that was, you know, highly rated, young, and getting a very good fee for him. Between 30 to 40 million pounds. And that's the kind of deal that you need. You know, look at Liverpool, they've signed Thiago. I mean, how the hell they've managed to pull that off, I've no idea. But that's what Woodward's got to do, whilst also being told, you've got to sign Sancho, you've got to sign, you know, Upamecano from Leipzig, you know, you've got to spend 200 million. That just doesn't exist anymore. And I mean, it's a difficult thing. And as you say, Gregor, it's like these little incrementals. So they'd be better off, surely, maybe picking one position between now and the end of the window and going, right, let's try and improve that one position, and then maybe make an incremental improvement. And that, to me, would be signing a better left-back than Luke Shaw, because I don't know where you're going to get good value to improve Lindelof in this window with this time to go. Hugh, I don't know whether you've got, as a United fan, is there one position you'd want to see them improve?
Well,
if I could give you one signing.
Mate, we've already got a player called Chris Smalling who's better than Victor Lindelof, to be perfectly honest. We don't have to go into the market to get a better centre-back. There is one position. Look, left-back, I think, needs addressing. I find it odd that they sold a centre-forward for £78, £79 million in Lukaku. Still haven't got a replacement for him. I mean, Odi Ighalo was given an extended loan deal. I mean, is that the sort of player that a club like Manchester United needs? I find that to be very, very odd. Thomas Partey's release clause, €50 million. Find it odd that we didn't go in for him. Upamecano, I think Leipzig, they were talking about €37.5 million. Didn't go in for him. I mean, all these things could happen by the end of the window. But I would rather have got two, even squad players, people that you'd say are the 13th, 14th and 15th players, you know, best players at the club. I'd rather improve that area than thinking that we need even first choice players, because the depth is poor at Manchester United and the depth loses them games like this. They put out their best team, they score four or five against Brighton and Bournemouth and people rave about them. You know, these are the games that decide where they finish in the league ultimately. You know, the harder games against tougher sides who maybe aren't the most brilliant teams in the league, but certainly if you're not 100% on it, you won't win. Listen, in terms of Manchester United's transfer dealings, listen, I asked who's to blame. I'm one of those people that likes to blame Ed Woodward for the squad being as it is, because that's his role. But I also think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer needs responsibility, because you heard me criticise Frank Lampard for his one season at Chelsea, because they had the same issues at the start of the season and the end of the season. I was like, a good coach solves issues over 50 games. I mean, 50 games to sort out a glaring error in the way that your team plays. If you don't do that, for me, you're not a great coach. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been there almost 2 years. Same way of losing matches, same way of not creating chances, same way of losing these matches at home as well, has been evident throughout. So what do you want me to say? You know, the manager at some point, he will end up taking responsibility, because Ed Woodward's the Teflon Don of Manchester United. I mean, nothing sticks to him. Doesn't matter how badly they play. So it will be Ole Gunnar Solskjaer before it's him. Ah, rant over. I can breathe.
Silence
again.
On the other end.
Yeah, I know. This is not me taking care of my voice at all, by the way. Look, let's talk about a more positive result. In fact, it's more positive for me because I tipped Spurs to be in the top four at the end of the season after they lost on the opening weekend and stank out the place. I was getting a lot of messages from people saying, what about that shout for Spurs for top floor? So I was happy to see them score rafter goals this weekend, their campaign giving the kiss of life, Harry Kane, Heung-min Son. I mean, 5-2 against Southampton, you know, it's not the result of the season, but four goals for Son, a goal and four assists for Kane. Amazing day for both of those and those that had them in their fantasy teams. Really annoyed that one of my best mates had them both. Spurs fan that had them both. So I thought I had a great week. Virtually all my players scored at least one goal, including James Justin. But I've been beaten in my league once again. Listen, Spurs brilliance. Let's focus on them rather than my fantasy team. Was it more brilliance from Tottenham or was it more ineptitude from Southampton that meant we saw that scoreline at St Mary's? What do you think?
It's a bit of both. I mean, Southampton, they pressed high, but they didn't press the ball. So, you know, that's a recipe for disaster. But having said that, some of Kane's through balls for Son were just exquisite, particularly the last one. It's kind of past that, you know, most people are basically facing the touchline, and one glance over his shoulder, he's taken in the whole vista, the whole picture, and he's just put it on his on a plate. It's an absolutely exquisite pass. So, you know, they were punished. If you looked at like the XG and the chances created and stuff, there wasn't that much between it. Southampton had plenty of chances and opportunities of their own, and, you know, with better finishing, it might have been a different scoreline, but they were punished severely. And, you know, it's got to be a little bit worrying for Southampton, the number of goals they're conceding. And, you know, they can go from being this really kind of high-octane, thrilling team that when it clicks, they're a real handful to play against, to looking really so disjointed and you know, giving up so many chances. So a little bit worrying for Southampton. They're kind of a bit of a yo-yo team at the moment. And so I think, you know, it was both. Southampton really, really kind of sort of stretched and left huge gaps for Spurs to take advantage of, and they certainly did.
There is an issue with Southampton to me in that, speaking of fantasy football, I remember a game last season when Manchester City lost 1-0 there, and I had a half a team full of Manchester City players and watched in agony as they missed chance after chance after chance. They do always seem to give the opposition chances. They're not, you know, the kind of Sean Dyche Burnley type team who, when they win at home, they're very solid and, you know, dogged. They do press incredibly well, but the trouble is with any pressing side, if you can beat the press, you're in behind them and you've found space. I would say that they're a very exciting team. They're great for a neutral. I would always watch Southampton because you know you're going to get an entertaining game one way or another. But as Gregor said, if as a Southampton fan, I'd perhaps be a little bit worried. I would also just like to say that perhaps, you know, we, the media in general, owe Harry Kane a little bit of a nod to a few years ago when we were all talking about, oh, Harry Kane can't score goals anymore, blah, 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 blah. And a few people, Tottenham fans in particular, were telling me, no, he's changing his game. And he was starting to do that, you know, dropping deeper a bit more to link the play. And then, you know, you're now seeing the benefits of that and seeing what an incredibly talented overall attacking player he's become. You know, he burst onto the scene, it was all about scoring goals, getting in behind, getting on the end of chances. As Gregor said, some of that creative play, some of the vision, if that had been Bruno Fernandes, Thiago, etc., you know, it would have been endless discussion about it. I know he's got praise, but I do think there's an element of where he should be acknowledged for how well he's changed his game and improved and broadened out his game to the benefit of others and to the benefit of Tottenham, to make sure that he's not just that one-trick pony getting in the box. I mean, those assists were absolutely unbelievable, I think. They were fantastic.
To be fair to Gareth Southgate, I think we saw a lot of that that came through with England, through to the 2018 World Cup. I think, you know, that was almost more, it was more obvious with England than it was at Tottenham that he was becoming that player who, you know, the way that England were playing, where he would drop deep and then you'd have flyers like, you know, Sterling and Rashford going off. So, you know, I think, I'm sure Harry Kane would give a nod to Southgate as well for developing that part of his football. But obviously when you've got a player like Son to run through, it's when, yeah, and you have a defence like that that's just asking for those balls to be flipped behind. I mean, it's interesting, I saw Mourinho saying that obviously Højbjerg had sort of given them a rundown on, you know, this is how Southampton will play, you know, this is the lock we have to pick. And it was, you know, I think when you saw the first one happen, you think, oh, well, that's, you know, they'll do something to fix that. And then, yeah, by about the fifth one, you're thinking, yeah, they clearly haven't got the message.
I do love the fact that Jose Mourinho immediately came out and made it so that Pierre-Emile Højbjerg can never go back to Southampton ever again. Just sold him out completely with his first answer in his first interview.
He also did that thing with Son, didn't he, about, you know, interrupting his interview afterwards. When you see this player and he's, you know, absolutely on, you know, cloud nine, he scored the goals and, you know, he's having and suddenly, you know, manager interrupts and says, Harry Kane, best player.
Yeah.
And you just think, like, thanks.
I think Jose must think he's just permanently being recorded on a documentary now.
Yeah, that did feel like you were watching the Amazon documentary, yeah.
You do wonder whether he's there doing the washing up, like commentating to himself and just thinking the whole time, I'm being filmed here. It's like he's always been a bit of a performer, but it seems like everything he's doing now is he's just conscious of, are they watching me?
I mentioned that line that I got messaged by a Spurs fan in high dudgeon because I'd sort of called them, yeah, less a football team and more of a soap opera now, because on the back of watching the entirely staged non-documentary that was the... the All or Nothing series. But yeah, I think you're right. It just feels like it's the sort of, you know, Jose's just going to sort of pop up and try and sort of crash any scene that's going, basically.
I did feel a little bit sad for Son in that moment, because I haven't seen a player score four goals before and then his manager go in front of all the cameras, you weren't the man of the match, someone else was. But testament maybe to Harry Kane's performance, as you pointed out. Interestingly as well, some of the reaction to that those five goals and those two playing so well was sort of an element of, if you add a Gareth Bale to all of this, well then Spurs are going to be absolutely sensational, and imagine what Bale will bring to that front three. And I saw people asking, is it going to be as good as any front three in the Premier League? And I thought all of that was exaggerated and way too soon as well, mainly because Gareth Bale's not going to be fit for ages. But I think when you really look at the way that Gareth Bale plays, he's an excellent player, but is he going to fit in that sort of selfless element that Kane and Son usually bring to their play? Because I think that's part of the reason that they often link up so well. Both of them has an eye for a goal, but also both of them likes to put the other one in. And the way that Bale cuts in so centrally onto his left foot, that negates sometimes the player running through the middle. Okay, you can slip the ball through, but we know what Bale likes to do. He likes to curl it towards the far post, have a smash. He's got a great left foot, but it narrows the play, if you see what I mean. Unless one of them's going to overlap on the other side. I'm not going to say that they're not going to play well together, but, you know, this element that, oh my God, they're both going to score 20 goals each, Kane and Son. And what, imagine if Bale scores a 20 as well? Well, I just don't think it's going to be like that. I don't think if Bale comes and excels in front of goal, I think that will take something away from the other two's goal scoring rather than add goals necessarily.
I think Bale, you know, Bale's sort of, his game's changed a bit too. He can play through the middle. He could, you know, Kane could still be that guy who's dropping off to link play. And actually, Bale could be that guy too. I think there's a lot of, you know, flexibility in that front three when it eventually manifests itself. So, you know, also the stature, the fact that Harry Kane is Mr. Spurs, he's the guy that everyone, you know, relies upon. You saw referring to the documentary again, you know, it was like a death in the family when Harry Kane injured his ankle, was it, I think? No, his hamstring. He kind of tore his hamstring in the documentary, and it was like he's out for 3 months, and the medical staff looked like they, you know, they were terrified to tell Jose. So, you know, having another player that's of that stature, I think that can only be good for Spurs. It takes the kind of heat off Kane, and I think there's potential for flexibility and a bit of fluidity in that front three, personally, because I think they're all quite adaptable.
Agree, Matt, nodding along?
I think so. I mean, I think the biggest thing, and obviously, you know, the fact that, you know, no sooner they sort of drum rolled the announcement he was joining, that they then have to say, oh, excuse me, he's not going to be playing for a month. I think, you know, we have seen him, obviously for Wales, we've seen him, you know, 5 minutes here or there for Real Madrid. But I think the fascination I have as a fan is just wondering what is left, you know, of his I mean, I think, you know, you used to sort of call it bionic sort of running powers. I mean, it, you know, that it was one of the great sights in world sport, was to see Gareth Bale at full tilt. I mean, you know, we go back to the Inter Milan and the class and the goal he scored in the Copa del Rey, and, you know, we've seen him, you know, run off the pitch and still beat players back, and it was a phenomenon. I mean, it was, you know, and yeah, I just haven't seen enough of him regularly. No one has, because he hasn't been playing, to know how much of that power is left. And that's one of the, I think, you know, great fascinations of this deal, is that, you know, he's 31. You know, that's, you know, he shouldn't be too old for it. But at the same time, you know, say he's got this injury, he's had bits and bobs of injuries at Real Madrid. And yeah, I just think, you know, we're talking about, could he do that sun roll through the middle? Can he, you know, what type of addition is he going to be to that attacking front three? Well, until we see what is left of that running power, extraordinary running power, it's almost hard to know, isn't it?
It's going to be a difficult call, I think, as you hinted at, Hugh, for Jose to make in terms of when he plays him and where he plays him. Because there is an element of where, if, as Matt suggests, he's not the same player that we loved back, you know, all those years ago in the Premier League, you know, the likes of Lucas Moura, Lamella, they do a hell of a lot of defensive work for Tottenham as well. And they do a hell of a lot of work off the ball, linking play. I mean, there's an element as well with Gareth Bale. You wonder whether just purely the aura will have a factor for the first few games when he plays. You know, teams will be so preoccupied about what Gareth Bale is going to do. What's he going to do? You know, maybe Harry Kane will start scoring even more goals and maybe he'll benefit a little bit. But that's where maybe Tottenham fans and we as football fans might have to dampen our, you know, excitement a little bit and think that maybe this Gareth Bale will be, I don't know, a completely different beast, and we'll have to accept a Gareth Bale that does the odd few good little linking tricks, flicks, gets a few assists, maybe bangs the odd one in the top corner. But it's not going to be the same season, that season under VS Boas. I mean, that was just a complete one-off piece of brilliance, wasn't it?
Interestingly, when I was thinking about how they might play, you mentioned, Matt, the running power of Gareth Bale and the aura. If he has either of those two things to the same degree, and Jose wants to play this, I hate to use the term, low block, deep defensive style, and then break on teams, if he still has that running power, Gareth Bale, and if Son, we know what great running power he has and he shows in abundance at the weekend as well, then we might see this role for Harry Kane where he drops a little bit deeper. And if you're going to break quickly on teams, do you push Gareth Bale up? And does he suddenly become the focal point of your attack, Gareth Bale? In which case, again, you take something slightly away from Harry Kane in terms of his ability to score as many goals.
I think the thing that struck me about Tottenham's win at the weekend was that it clearly Kane and, you know, Kane finding pockets of space to play through Son, you know, to take advantage of how much of a high line they play. That was kind of like a striking tactical sort of plan. And that's rare for Tottenham now. So this is the thing. Gareth Bale actually is a big galactical signing, and that's what Jose Mourinho really is kind of used to doing, and that's what he wants. So, you know, I actually think we're probably, you know, we're maybe overanalyzing this a little bit. I think he'll just think, I can put Gareth Bale, Harry Kane and Son in the front three and we'll get the ball up to them, and they're three, you know, world-class players. That's the kind of thing that Jose Mourinho does. The thing, you know, although the documentary was a, as Matt says, it wasn't really a documentary, it was a kind of PR thing. The amount he talked about pressing was really striking to me, and that Tottenham's pressing really doesn't look, it looks pretty much non-existent. So, you know, that's one thing, you know, Hugh, you alluded to that, you know, Gareth Bale, Kane, Son does a lot of work, Moura does, but, you know, I'm not sure how he fits into that, if that's what he sees for in Tottenham's future, you know?
Listen, Bale's coming through the door. Let's move on to a player who might be going out of the door, left out of the squad at the weekend at Spurs and for their game in the Europa League, back-to-back games, not even on the bench, for England's Dele Alli. What's gone wrong for Dele Alli? Do we think he'll leave the club? It's surprising in a way, because I think we saw his reputation grow and grow. But over the last couple of seasons, it's not surprising. He's just not at the level that Spurs would want.
I think Dele Alli is one of those players in modern football that suffered a little bit from being very talented, very young, and being able to play in quite a few different roles, to quite a good 7, 8 out of 10 level. And that maybe has meant that now, when he should be at the peak of his powers, he's suffered a little bit. You know, we saw him burst onto the scene, breaking into the box, scoring headed goals, getting on the end of crosses. For England, he played in that kind of midfield five, had to drop deep, do a lot of defensive work at the 2018 World Cup. I think it's most striking when whenever I speak to friends who are Tottenham fans, I get a lot of different analysis as to what Dele Alli is and what his best position is. You see him have a game where he's nipping into tackles, maybe gets booked, has a bit of fire in his belly, you know, nicking the ball. And one Tottenham fan says, that's Dele Alli, that's what Dele Alli does. Then another game where he's flicking and pulling off outrageous little tricks and flicks. And another Tottenham fan says, that's what Dele Alli does. And no one really knows. And how do you convey that into one position on a football pitch? You can't. Because, you know, that role doesn't exist. So he fills different roles, I think, to a very effective manner, but in a not maybe a headline-grabbing way that he did at the start of his career. So I think maybe Jose's taking a decision that maybe we can get a decent fee for him. We've got three attacking players, as we've already discussed. Can make the midfield very solid. I can make $40 million from Dele Alli. But I don't think that should reflect badly on Dele Alli necessarily. I don't think his career's gone that badly, really.
I agree with that. I mean, I think there was, you know, he was generally, you know, a sort of number 10 when he was making his name in those early times at Tottenham. He, as Tom says, sort of flicks around the box, breaking into the box. And I think the nature of how Tottenham's developed and how England developed, he's had to, well, the pressure's been on him to become a number eight, basically. Someone who's, you know, playing with sort of driving play forward more, and there's been some faltering in that. But, you know, I think we have to consider his attitude as well. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, I think, yeah, there was a time where when it started to go wrong with England, Southgate left him out, wasn't happy with his attitude in training. We've obviously seen from the non-documentary that Jose, you know, feels like he's, you know, and it sort of becomes one of the biggest themes of that, of just how, you know, Mourinho instantly decides that he's got to prod him and got to wind him up and got to be on his case all the time. It's, you know, I think it's the sort of, yeah, almost like the biggest theme from it is just this, you know, he decided that that's what it's going to take. And I think if it was just Jose, I would sort of wonder, you know, wonder if it says more about the manager than the player. But the fact is that Southgate had issues with him as well about application and focus. And I think, you know, that has to be part of weighing up. I think there's been sort of developmental issues in him as a player and say in that role, which I think that's just a young player trying to work out, you know, what he does best. But I do think he has, you know, faltered himself temperamentally as well.
I'd say maybe one more reference to the non-documentary. Maybe everyone's just really, really bored of his mundane conversation while lying on a bed waiting for a massage, asking things like, what's your favourite chocolate bar? Or what do you do? Do you put the water on the toothpaste when you're brushing your teeth first, or do you put the toothpaste on first, then the water? It's like, oh my God. Honestly, 15 years I spent listening to that kind of conversation, and I was in the physio room. I was like, wow.
Gregor, make sure we never go for a drink, because that is exactly my pub chat.
Okay.
Love noted. That kind of thing. If you could only eat one fruit for the rest of your life, what would it be?
I was very surprised to see him linked in the papers with Paris Saint-Germain. I mean, but then I remembered that Eric Maxim Choupo-Moting plays for Paris Saint-Germain, who is clearly the Leicester City of football transfers. Well, Leicester City won it. Well, Choupo-Moting does play for them, so I guess anyone's got a shot. I mean, I don't know what he offers to Paris Saint-Germain, but I think you're right. If Jose Mourinho gets the right money, then he could be leaving the club. Well, mentioning just something you referred to, Gregor, I am sort of always... I'm always wary of Jose Mourinho and his desire to always make it about one particular player at any given moment in time, even if they're not in the team. You know, there always seems to be a focus on a player who's not quite up to scratch. And sometimes I feel it is a bit about him sending a message to the rest of the squad. You know, I gave Dele an opportunity. He didn't listen to my way. Now he's in Paris or wherever he ends up. And I think he almost tried that with Ndombele to begin with. And now he's moved on to Dele Alli. You know, whether they're in the team or not, I am always wary that he wants to send a message to the rest of the squad with certain players. And I'm just hoping that Dele Alli isn't currently the player that he's focused on. But there you go. Lots of chat about Spurs. There you go, Spurs fans. You'll be happy this week. You're listening to the Game Podcast from The Times. Just a reminder, we've got brand new episodes Monday, Thursday as well. Make sure you hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. You'll stay in the loop with everything we've got for you.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One thing, by the way, that was evident, in fact, just talking about Spurs again in their win over Southampton more widely, some atrocious defending so far this season, generally speaking, across the games. 62 goals scored in the Premier League in just 16 matches, an average of nearly 4 goals a game. Well, 3.875 per game to be exact. But are we basically watching, because we had no real preseason, are we basically watching teams currently figuring out how they should be playing and currently still getting used to being out there on the pitch? Gregor, what's it like to have no preseason and then try and throw yourself back in there?
The number of injuries I had, I could say that really was most seasons for me. It's tough. No, it is, because there's something like... I remember when I first kind of hung up my boots, I wrote a few months had passed and I wrote a piece about, you know, how the sort of realisation dawning that it was over. And the thing I missed at that moment in time most was the feeling of absolute peak fitness and having, you know, you for 6 weeks or whatever, you put your body through, you know, hell, but it feels damn good at the end of it. And that, you know, the players, they won't have that now. They can't possibly have that. They've not had enough of time to have a rest and they've not had enough time to really get to that peak fitness level as well. So, yeah, I think we probably will see an element of that this season. I think also possibly the fact that there's no fans in the stadium still. I think that, you know, personally, if you're playing in a game and there's not that same sensory sort of overload around you, everything is just drops of a percent or two. So I think there's probably a few factors. I also think, though, just if you look around, how many clubs in the Premier League need defenders? I mean, I think you could say West Ham, Leicester, Burnley, Man United. I'd say Man City still are going to try and sign another centre-half. You know, Arsenal got Gabriel, but you could probably have another. Spurs, Dier's not looking up too much. There are a lot, you know, it's a position that a lot of clubs are desperately looking for players and they're not really finding them either. So I think there probably is an issue with the kind of quality of defending as well.
I was speaking to a Premier League manager last week about that, and the thing he stressed most of all, basically, almost literally the cry was out of sort of, do you know any good centre-halves out there? It was, I think it's been a problem position for a couple of years, I think, in terms of scouting, almost the hardest one to block. And I think that's definitely one of, I think, quite a few factors. I mean, Leeds to be fair, Leeds are on a position to make this a record scoring season, obviously. Absolutely, themselves, yeah. Aren't they? And we are early on, but I think all those factors Gregor mentions are true. But yeah, we can ignore the fact that I just think the images are, you know, they are scratching their head a bit, thinking, you know, it's a good time to, yeah, to be a talented centre half, because your value is on the rise, that's for sure.
I think there's another element to the pre-season thing in the modern football, with so much analysis that goes on the data teams that top sides have. I mean, Greg, I don't know how much this was a factor as well. As well as being fit and being prepared physically, being prepared off the pitch in terms of your research you've done. If you think about the turnaround we've had, you know, if a team, a defence coach wanted to go back and go through with a right back, okay, this is what your season was like. This is where you were strong. But look at this, 6 games in a row, you got turned on the inside and, you know, the guy got a shot away. There wasn't that time for anyone to do that kind of work. Yeah, it'll still happen, I'm sure, and they'll have crammed it in. But in terms of that, you know, if you think about Raheem Sterling with Pep Guardiola and the pre-season, when we saw him drilling into him, you know, take the ball, turn, get a shot off. And that kind of coaching work surely can't happen in the short space of time, can it? I mean, I don't know what it was like back in your day, Gregor, when you were playing, in terms of the prep you would do on your last season, where you could improve, the teams and players you're going to be coming up against? Or was that a week-to-week thing that'll happen anyway?
I think the main thing is the, yeah, really preparation for the next game. And it really is a case now that, I can't remember, I was reading an interview the other day, that was, you know, basically you play the game, you have a rest recovery day, and the next day is kind of preparation for the next game. And so you'll be going through kind of team and tactical overview things, but I think you're probably right. There'll be less time to work on individual matters like that. But personally, I think the biggest issue is the fact that there's a kind of dearth of quality defenders. I also think one other thing is that it's been a gradual move. This hasn't happened just overnight. Is that there's a lot more asked of, particularly central defenders now. You know, they often have the most touches of any player on the pitch during a game, and they, you know, play the most passes, and, you know, building the play from the back. And we've seen, you know, Arsenal or Chelsea are kind of taking this to new lengths as well, and trying to build out from the back, and maybe not always quite good enough, as Kepa proved. So there's also an element of defenders are being asked to do more, and they're taking more risks, and that's obviously going to give up more chances. So it's also maybe a stylistic element to the way the game's travelling as well.
I mean, I guess on the value, just look at what's happening. Is it, you know, Tarkowski's what? I mean, his value's, you know, they're going up to 30, 35 million plus. I mean, you're thinking, hang on a minute. you know, he's a good jobbing Premier League centre half, but, you know, if you're talking, you know, 30 million plus, that just shows the problem, really.
I think one of the interesting things for me in terms of players at Burnley, for example, over the years, is clearly Sean Dyche gets them to defend really, really well in his system. And, you know, Michael Keane went to Everton and then was getting exposed every single week and didn't look half the player. And I just worry that James Tarkowski might leave Burnley and we suddenly might be thinking, what on earth's going on here? Because the system is great for the defenders. Even Ben Mee, who in fact, when Michael Keane was at the club, struggled to regularly start. And he looks a fantastic defender now, but there's an element of they defend as a team, they defend aggressively. You know, they haven't got a particularly high line. And obviously you move higher up the league and suddenly you're one-on-one with Raheem Sterling on the halfway line. That is a totally different job to defending the edge of the 6-yard box. 18-yard box.
But that's an interesting point, isn't it? And that links what you said with what Gregor said about whether the way game is changing. Over the last 5-10 years, attackers have had to do more defending. And now defenders have got to do more creative play. You know, and this is almost why I wonder where the modern fascination with fullbacks is coming from, because they can defend, they're quick, they're agile, they can attack. You know, we're going to get to a point, you saw people doing it, joking about the talented England right backs. You should just have a team full of fullbacks across the pitch who can create, maybe have one striker up front who you know is going to score some goals, because that is a massive part of defending. If your midfield and attack aren't working for you, you're just going to be exposed and have players turned running at you. And yeah, you're going to look like a pretty crap defender if you've got no help around you. So that's massive element to me in the way the game is changing.
What's interesting is, I think, you know, we saw Fernandinho play centre-back for Manchester City last year quite successfully, given his age. And, you know, the physical demands. He was, I think, at some certain points, fantastic. Fabinho played centre-back for Liverpool this weekend and did a pretty good job. There was talk of Declan Rice leaving West Ham to go to Chelsea to play centre-back, you know, holding midfielders by trade.
And Didi did now, it for Leicester as well this weekend, I think, yeah.
I was wondering about McTominay. I was arguing about it with one of my kids the other day about whether McTominay would be better off, you know, given what we were talking about United's defensive problems, trying him there.
If you saw him for Scotland, though, I'm not sure. You may be right back on that one.
You know, and I think it is interesting because when we've seen as well a lot of fullbacks playing a back three, where previously we might have said the fullback is going to be the weaker one in a back three. In fact, because they are more agile, because they're usually quicker, because a lot of them are good on the ball, more forward thinkers in fullback positions as well. So those forward passes are usually better quality. I don't think we're going to see a fullbacks all the way across a back four, but certainly if you're a pretty tall midfielder who can head it and read play, then you've got a chance of playing centre-back at the moment. So it's going to be an interesting one. But I think, I wonder how long we'll see these goals, because I do think that the crowd plays a difference, and I think the intensity will go up. I think these first couple of weeks, you know, it's not that the games have completely lacked intensity, but I think the concentration level and the aggression level, fans make a difference. You know, the concentration level for me hasn't been great. Even if I watched, I think, the final goal yesterday, and not to call out Carl Walker-Peters in particular, but he had a look at Son, who was closer to the goal than he was and onside, decided he wasn't going to get back goal side of him, thought about it again, still decided he wasn't going to get goal side of him, tried to step up at one point, and they've already scored four goals, three of them already at that point from Son. He stepped up and let him run at goal. I mean, those sorts of things have to get ironed out, and I think that will come with, you're right, Tom, the coaching and the time to work on things. So we'll see. Look, I'd be delighted if every goal has four goals in it for the rest of the season, but I don't think it'll be great for the league.
It's worth keeping an eye on, definitely, though. I mean, just to add, there was 100 goals in, I think, 34 games in the EFL, across the EFL as well, on Saturday alone. So, like, you know, the external factors could be playing a significant role. So it's definitely worth keeping an eye on.
But that goes down the leagues as well. You know, Gregor, you watch a lot of Football League as well. You know, we've seen it, haven't we? Even down into League One, League Two, teams trying to play out from the back, wanting to play possession football. That's where it's going to come from. You know, I remember a game a few seasons ago, or maybe last season, I think it was Rochdale got hammered by Peterborough or something, was it? And I think four of the goals all came from defenders passing it straight to a striker and them scoring. But then later in the season, Rochdale played some great stuff. But that's where, you know, that's the desire, isn't it, in modern football, to play that way. And that's until people get it right, there's going to be a load of goals.
Well, as I say, and as if I don't talk about QPR enough on this podcast, but all you have to do is watch QPR to realise that, yeah, absolutely, there is an ambition to play like, you know, Man City, Barcelona, and then, you know, complete incapability of doing it under any type of pressure. But it's like, you know, I admire the ambition, I admire the intent. And I scream every time it goes wrong. So it's, they are the case in point. And I think, as you say, a lot of teams, you know, this, we could whole new different podcast on whether this, you know, is this all Guardiola, that he's brought this, you know, obviously not him alone, but I think he is, yeah, he's had a big impact on that aspiration, that ambition.
There is one glaringly obvious, I think, reason for the goals going up in the Premier League that we just haven't stumbled upon yet. But thankfully, it's covered in the final word in the Times today. The new handball rule, mate. There's going to be 20 more goals a weekend from here on out. Anytime it touches a defender's arm in the box, it looks like it's going to be a penalty now, except if you're Gabriel, the Arsenal defender, who basically missed his header and it landed on his arm, which for me, actually, looking at some of the other penalties that were given this weekend, I'm surprised it wasn't. In particular, Victor Lindelof, Manchester United against Crystal Palace, given as a penalty. I thought that was insane. And then Spurs' Matt Doherty versus Southampton. I looked up the rules. I spent all night on IFAB trawling through why these were handballs. And in all honesty, the rules themselves haven't particularly changed. But the interpretation, the Premier League has adopted what has been going on for the last couple of years in the rest of the world, which seems basically, it seems from the outside that, of course, we don't really take into account whether it's deliberate or whether the player meant to handle it. If their arm is away from their body and the ball hits it, it's going to be a penalty now.
Yeah, and I, you know, as someone who has spent far too long defending VAR, then it's this makes it hard. It makes it harder than anything, actually. And I think, I mean, Tony Cascarino in the last word makes the, I think, the most pertinent point about all of this, which is the penalty is totally out of whack with the crime. You know, it's here. You know, here is a ball that's bounced around, bounced off someone, hit an arm that is raised because, you know, someone is just in that sort of, you know, in an awkward position or whatever, and suddenly you're a goal down on something that is, you know, basically pinball. And I think that's the issue. The issue is that it feels out of whack, and that's why people are getting so angry about it. Not that we need any excuse, but yeah, I think of all the bits of VAR that are, you know, this is the hardest to defend, because it you know, I think the game can adapt to a lot of different things. I think it has to learn to adapt, and I still think, you say, if we can't get VAR right, then we're being a bit thick. But this bit, I think the, you know, let's not blame the referees, I'm afraid. We, you know, easy as that, you know, that is, and people love to do, this is a problem for the lawmakers, and they've got it wrong. There's no two ways about it.
They're trying to make it so that there's more scope for consistency of decisions, but I don't think it's going to work, because, you know, the thing about VAR is that, you know, offside decisions, even the newly kind of stricter directive about goalkeepers not leaving the line in a penalty kick, they're objective. You can't, you know, that's black and white, really. The handball can never be that, because even if you say outside the silhouette, an unnatural silhouette, that's subjective. And, you know, I think that Lindelof's position was natural. You know, he's got to be balanced. He's got to say that you've got to have your hands beside your side is just a complete nonsense, really. And I think the thing that really the law should be focusing on is really, if the does the defender have the opportunity to avoid handling the ball? That's not the same as intent, because, you know, intentional is gone, that's out the window. But if they didn't have the opportunity to avoid handling the ball, then I think, again, it comes back to the punishment doesn't fit the crime. You know, Doherty's was a completely like absolute lunacy. It deflected, I think, off Winks's boot and bounced up off his arm. And what the heck has he got to do to get out of the way of that? And again, the punishment, he's only just inside the penalty box. The punishment doesn't fit the crime. And I think this has got to change. It's the law.
I mean, we've given them an absolute kicking just a minute ago, but you'd hate to be a defender in modern football, wouldn't you? How the hell do you try and defend in the box with your hands behind your back and, you know, keep agile? Because, as you know, you used to hear it a lot with free kicks and things given, with people challenging in the air. Alan Shearer always used to say it, didn't he? You can't jump without using your arms. You can't defend without, you know, whoever you're playing, whenever you're having a kick about in the park with your mates, you throw an arm out, don't you, and try and stop someone running or keep pace with them. And that's where you're going to get ones like Doherty, where it hits three other people, bounces up and catches your little finger. It's so unfair to the defender that it's going to make it incredibly hard. And you have situations like in the Champions League final where you get people accusing, was it Mane, of, you know, almost kicking the ball in the arm region to try and win a penalty. It's a similar thing to diving, where you play for the foul. You're looking up as a striker, right, I'm in the box, right, is he going to throw his arm up, right, now, yeah, got it, bang, penalty.
That's what my old friend Glenn Hoddle was saying on telly yesterday. I think he was saying that, you know, you could imagine, as a coach, he could imagine almost practicing that, you know, learning how to sort of do a dummy, get a defender to throw his arms up and flicking it at it. I mean, if that, you know, I think that may be stretching it, but, you know, you're certainly going to be teaching defenders to sort of run with a, you know, like they're in a straitjacket, and that's just as daft.
I mean, looking through the IFAB laws last night, it is not a penalty if the attacking player deliberately kicks the ball at the arm of the defender. How on earth is the referee going to be able to judge that, even if you watch it back? I mean, if you're in a wide area, no one's in the box, don't you just blast it at the defender's arm and say you were crossing it, even if no one's there? I mean, it doesn't make any real sense. And one of the issues for me is, it doesn't improve the game. It doesn't enhance the game. I would rather see a penalty given. Imagine this scenario. I would rather see the fourth official say to Jurgen Klopp at the weekend, Christensen has denied Mane a goal-scoring opportunity outside of the box, but it was a goal-scoring opportunity. You can have a penalty and he'll stay on, or you can have the red card and a free kick. I would rather see that in the game than see Matt Doherty's penalty given when Gineppo was trying to roll the ball into his striker's feet, who had his back to goal. It did not deny a goal-scoring opportunity, and then one is given to the team. I mean, what's the point in giving a penalty? I mean, I've always thought this is before handball. I've always thought a penalty should be given if you denied a goal-scoring opportunity, because the result is a goal-scoring opportunity. Whereas obviously, if a player has his back to goal in the corner of the penalty area, he's about to roll it back to his fullback and he gets fouled, it wasn't a goal-scoring opportunity. Why would you give a penalty for that? I'm not trying to change the entire rules of the game, but all I would say is, if you are going to change the rules of the game, it has to improve it. I mean, this in no way improves football. It just doesn't. The penalties that we saw given, Victor Lindelof could not have done anything about the ball hitting his arm. He wasn't opening his body up trying to block a shot. He was running back to try and cover the goal. I mean, I don't blame the referees. The rules are there, and I think they did enforce them correctly. And I think Martin Atkinson was almost like, I'm really annoyed that I have to give this. It probably makes us all look bad, but letter of the law is, it's a penalty.
I think Graham Souness made this kind of peak football man comment, but he was probably right when he said that if you were to do a poll of professional footballers, none would say that these should be handballs. And I think that's a problem. That's a big problem. I think the other thing that's kind of irony about VAR is that it's made everyone realise that they want the final decision to rest in the hands of the referee on the pitch. You know, I think this should be something that the referee, I'd be happier if the referee was deciding always, you know. And I know it won't always be perfect then, but I think if at least we're seeing the referees using monitors for some things now. I just think that their hands are kind of tied behind their back, boom, boom, with the laws that they have to deal with now. Even the kind of old T-shirt rule. I mean, it's just madness. It's absolute madness.
Your arm apparently begins beneath your armpit level. That little top bit there is now officially your shoulder because football said so. And last year it wasn't. Last year it was part of your arm. But this year it has become part of your shoulder. And look, biologists everywhere going crazy, you know. Textbooks changing up and down the land, clearly, because of football. Like I say, it doesn't make football better. And although it's one of the many adjustments that we're going to have to make when it comes to VAR, Matt, I think you're right. It is, for me, I am one of those people as well that I think VAR is good. But I think this element of VAR has put us into the category of, I immediately thought, right, this is it. We're in the mode where we're going to start getting rid of things from VAR. And they'll get rid of this in a couple of seasons and it will be like the silver goal. And we'll get rid of a few of the other elements and we'll refine it. Because I don't think anyone really has a massive problem with offsides. There has to be a line somewhere, let's be honest. All right, we can argue about where that is. But I think it has been better, even though there has still been some contentious points. Goal line technology, aside from that game for Aston Villa against Sheffield United, has been perfect. And I think, look, if the ball crosses the line, now we know, pretty much. And that's perfectly fine. But I think some of the decisions, for example, the referee going over to the screen in the first couple of weekends has worked far better than we had last season when the referee didn't go over and have a check of the screen and make that final decision. So I think it's already being refined, but I think things like this won't last. They can't last because, I don't know if fans enjoy it. I don't think players will enjoy it. And I really can't see the benefit.
I do think there's been progress in the sense of, well, I think any reasonable person, and I know football makes many of us very unreasonable, but in reasonable thinking has realised that this system is to stay, and the issue now is to keep improving it rather than to what Harry don't like and say, it's got to go in the bin. You know, I would like to think we've reached a point where VAR is going to is here now, and the idea of taking this basic technology and shoving it in the bin just doesn't make sense. So it's here, and you're right, let's keep improving it, let's work out what we like, what we don't like, what works, what doesn't work. And it was never going to be perfect, and it was certainly never going to be a panacea, but let's just be intelligent enough. Like I say, I originally thought going to the screens was unnecessary, time consuming, and it actually is better that way. So, you know, let's keep making it work, as you say, to make the game better. You know, the fact is, Christensen would have stayed on the pit. That was a key decision in a game. And, you know, we spend most of our time arguing about how VAR's got it wrong. There is a classic case in what was an absolutely key decision for a match that VAR made right. So there we go. Happy news.
Just before we go, this week there is more live football. It doesn't stop, does it? Midweek, it's going to be the third round of the EFL Cup. Tom has come. He's got his colours on. He's ready for it. The game's not even until Thursday. He's going to be wearing a Lincoln shirt every single day this week until they face Liverpool on Thursday night. I mean, Tom, you've got to be feeling excited going into this one. You're the favourites, right?
I mean, excited is not the word. I should also just clarify that I wear a Lincoln kit most days, whether we're playing Liverpool or not. And I should also clarify that this is actually a training top, which is more of a Monday vibe. I'm saving the kits for the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I really don't want to be the grumpy old man right now, but when we beat Bradford to secure the game against Liverpool, the only real emotion I had was sadness, to be honest, because home to Liverpool, I grew up in Manchester, so I have a natural slight anger towards Liverpool anyway. Lincoln City at home and just no fans there. I mean, it's just one of the saddest things. And we're not the only ones. Leyton Orient home to Tottenham, Morecambe home to Newcastle, Luton home to Manchester United, no fans. And these are the games where fans make the entire spectacle completely different. Lincoln, I would say this, but we have a fantastic home following. We have a group called the 617 who stand in the corner like a bunch of crazy mad ultras and sing the whole way through the game. So whether Mo Salah turned up and we lost 7-0 or whether they play the kids and maybe we get a 2-1, it would have been an amazing atmosphere. And instead you have these players that have, you know, worked their way around in the Football League, and I'd be interested in Gregor's point on this, but you know, I just really don't want that feeling of, you know, Rian Brewster rolling in his hat trick to make it 6-0 and it's deathly silent. And that would just be, that's just so tragic, like, for those players. And I mean, it's just really sad. And I mean, I really don't want to come across as a complete party pooper. But even the idea of winning 1-0, I'm going to be sat in my living room watching it on telly. And I'm just going to be like, ah, what the hell? This is a once-in-a-lifetime chance, and there's no one there. There's nobody there. Nobody going crazy. There's, you know, the kit man's there with a drum trying to make as much noise as he can. And it's just, it's so tragic.
Tom, I'm amazed you haven't got accreditation, bought yourself a one-man band kit and just stood up in the press box, you know, playing your drum for the whole game. Why aren't you there?
Well, I've always taken the view that I never want to mix work with being a Lincoln fan, because it's
just... Well, you're doing it now,
mate. this is me as a fan, but I'm not going to go and report and have to say, you know, write an intro that says Rian Brewster was brilliant as Liverpool beat poor old Lincoln City 5-0. Not a chance. No, never going anywhere near... I'll try to get excited about it, but I just can't. And we're not the only ones. This to me is where fans, we're going to miss them the most.
I was at Luton at the weekend, and as you say, they're playing Manchester United for the first time since 1992. And then on Saturday, they go to the rivals Watford for the first time in 14 years at Vicarage Road. And it's like, you know, the players are kind of thinking this is, you know, really, really exciting and for the club, but the fans can't be there for two kind of big games that are a kind of sign of their revival. So, yes, it's sad. And it's going to be like that throughout the season, really, I think. I mean, hopefully we'll get fans in soon.
And I think we're going to end a lot of our podcasts just like that. Important that we get the fans back inside the ground soon. But in the meantime, we'll keep you right up to date with everything. You've been listening to The Game Podcast from The Times. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure you give us 5 stars, review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app. Hit subscribe, and you'll get Thursday's episode as well as soon as it's released. This has been The Game Podcast from The Times. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Thursday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.